Dr. Heckman is a distinguished professor of economics at the University of Chicago, a Nobel Prize winner in economics. He's an expert in the economics of human development. His groundbreaking work with a consortium of economists, developmental psychologists, sociologists, statisticians, and neuroscientists has proven that the quality of early childhood development heavily influences health, economic, and social outcomes for individuals and society at large. I'm very glad he's proved that because several of us have been saying that for a few years in Kentucky, and today we'll get proof that we were on the right track with it. It's always great when facts kind of, you know, line up with what we've been preaching, right, Stu? Well, they knew it all along, but Dr. Heckman is a distinguished scientist in this area. He received his BA in mathematics from Colorado College, his PhD in economics from Princeton in 71. He's been at the University of Chicago since 73, where he directs the Economics Research Center and the Center for Social Program Evaluation at the Harris School. He's a professor of science and society at the University College Dublin and also a senior research fellow at the American Bar Foundation. Heckman's work has been devoted to the development of a scientific basis for economic policy evaluation. In the early 90s, his pioneering research on the outcomes of people receiving their GED created a little bit of a stir and brought a lot of attention to the value or lack thereof of obtaining that particular certificate. His recent research focuses on human development and life cycle skill formation with a special emphasis on the economics of early childhood development. His research has given policymakers important new insights into such areas as education, job training programs, minimum wage legislation, anti-discrimination law, social supports, and civil rights. He's currently the associate editor of the Journal of Labor Economics, and he's a member of the National Academy of Sciences. So with that brief introduction of our distinguished guest, let's give him a Kentucky welcome to Louisville today and to our forum. Dr. Heckman.
Switch this on. Okay. Thank you very much for the kind remarks. I appreciate all the remarks and the enthusiasm in the room. In fact, it's a little dangerous, actually, to have too much enthusiasm. I am a scholar, and I do try to study and prioritize. So I'll try to share with you some thoughts. But I would completely agree with what Dave Adkison was just saying. But a lot of what I'm saying and a lot of what's the case for all this is really quite intuitive. It's pretty obvious. And in some sense, you don't need me. You can read in ancient texts going back thousands of years a lot of the wisdom that I think is ignored in public policy discussions. So what I want to talk about today is just kind of review the argument, which is common sense. And I think it's a good thing that it's common sense. It's there was a book, popular book, circulating about 7 years ago. It says, never trust your common sense. I think that's wrong. I think that what I'm giving you is common sense. But I also think that we need to think a little more deeply, maybe, about our common sense. So let me start. Here we go. So I want to talk to you about a problem that actually has received a lot of attention in the recent election cycle. One way to describe it is the skills problem. Another one is how you grow the middle class. And we know that both candidates for president have discussed this. It's hotly debated, and I think what I'm going to show you today is some idea, some notion about how you could actually answer the question that possibly neither candidate has really fully grasped. So I have to use this. So we know, let me just review a few very familiar facts. I'm going to use graphs. I'm an economist. I do use numbers. But I think these numbers are real, as opposed to some of the numbers we've heard recently. These are real. These are real. And they're all from very good sources. So, for example, we've seen, and this is from the Congressional Budget Office a year or so ago, a very important study, a very carefully done study, showing that there's no joke about the 1%, the 99 versus 1%. We've seen a huge growth. In fact, social and economic inequality is increasing, and the top 1% really has gotten a much bigger share and total income increase in the last 30 years. And so the social and economic inequality is increasing, and there's a lot of uncertainty out there. Uncertainty about policies, uncertainty about the future, uncertainty that's created a divided society and a polarized electorate, and we've seen good manifestations of that. And what we've also seen is stagnant real growth, growth in real wages. And so this is something that you've all seen. So all of this, what I'm about to say, I think, is very well known, but it's useful to review the facts because I want to consider a strategy that deals with these and other phenomena. So if you look at male wages, the story is a little different for women, but it's still true for a version of this is true for women in terms of differentials, that what you've seen in the last 30, 40 years is that people who have BA degrees, especially advanced degrees, law degrees, MBAs, and so forth, have really been getting a higher real wage in terms of people who work full-time year-round. And if you look at high school dropouts and even high school graduates, the wage growth has been not very good. For dropouts, it's actually decreased since 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And for people who are high school graduates, there's been stagnation. And so there really is a problem out there. Over long stretches the last 30 years, we've had real problems. And we know, in the whole election, or at least a big part of the discussion, not just at the national level, but at the state level, has really tried to address these questions. The disadvantaged are under stress. We know the housing market has collapsed. It's recovering in some states, but there's still a substantial portion of American citizens who have mortgages that are, quote, underwater. Housing prices continue to decline in some markets. And in addition to these problems of stagnant wages, there are other problems out there. So it's not hard to list problems, but I'll just remind you of them. Problems that have to do with healthcare costs, problems that have to do with crime, and problems in the larger society. And what we've seen in the last few years is in the discussion of inequality, we've seen a lot of politics, a lot of polarization instead of practicality. So let me just make some very obvious but important statements. And it's already been said, but I'll just remind you again. So we know skills are important. The skills are the major source of productivity. I mean, people have known this. Even Adam Smith, the founder of the subject of economics some 250 years ago, was writing about the importance of skill. And of course, if anything, skill has become far more important. Skills are major determinants of social advantage and disadvantage. So when you look at this inequality, it's no accident that it's by income, by education class. Education and income very closely correlated. And increasingly in the world, again, this is a trite statement, but it's true, that with globalization, with high-skilled workforces coming on board across the world now, not just in Europe, in the United States, and some parts of Asia as well, what we've seen is a tremendous growth in the wages, a skill bias, what economists would call a drift towards skilled workers, a shift. It's been universal across all countries. It's true even in less developed countries that we see that technology is shifting towards skilled workers. But what's happened in the United States is very bizarre. This is something that has been remarked on, but I think it's useful to remind you of what I think is a very important phenomenon. So at the same time that the demand for skilled workers has accelerated, and it's a worldwide phenomenon, in the United States, our overall rate of growth in producing skills has slowed down. We have more college graduates than before, but we also have more high school dropouts than before. And it's not just a question of migration. Now, let me just show you a figure which you've seen before, but if we look, for example, at these statistics, and if we look, properly count high school graduates, what we find is in the last birth cohort years, these are people born, these people would now be, say, around 70 years of age, 1942, born 1942. What you see is successive cohorts, say, between the years born 1900 to 1942, up to about 1950, more and more people are graduating high school, more and more people graduating college. There were blips, but the fact is there's been a steady growth. But what you've also seen is in the last 50 years or so, 60 years, birth cohort, 60, so people now 60 years of age, 62 years of age really, But in those cohorts, the percentage of people graduating high school has stagnated or even started to decline. And it's true, even for those people, exclude all Mexican immigrants, exclude everybody coming in from less developed countries. This is for Native Americans, people who are born in the United States, people who are educated in the United States, and we see a decline. And so the consequence of this is we've seen an increased high school dropout rate, increasing rate at which people are going to college, and a polarized society. So the blue collar, the middle class, the high school graduate group has actually been shrinking. And so what we've seen increasingly is two Americas have emerged, and society is polarized. And the inequality is very serious. And in fact, recent studies have questioned what is, I think, an important part of the American, I don't want to call it mythology, but our history, the Horatio Alger story about rags to riches in a single generation. What we've seen is the intergenerational persistence of income, what the father's income is in relationship to the son's income, is a correlation about 0.65. As a benchmark, Denmark is 0.07. China is about 0.6. What we see then is strong influence of who your parents are. The accident of birth shapes who you are as an adult. And this is something that actually challenges some of our important national goals. So what do we do about this? How do we address this skills problem? And I think it really is a skills problem. I think what we need to do is address the problem in a more comprehensive way than we have in the past. I think we have to formulate policies that recognize what skills matter, how they're produced, and how we should prioritize. And I keep emphasizing prioritization. For example, a couple of years ago, when the Bowles-Simpson Commission came out on the report, and all of the discussion about the budget deficit, which we will still hear much more of, even long after this presidential election is settled, we will see a lack of prioritization, partly because there's a lack of data, or there's a perceived lack of data. And what I want to try to do is suggest a more unified approach that's empirically based. And this is one that avoids fragmented and, I think, ineffective approaches to public policy that miss the pervasive importance of skills. So it's a skills problem that we have. So, for example, an example of a fragmented solution would be current policy discussions. It's not just here in the United States. I was in Beijing a week ago at this point discussing with the some of the leaders in China, China Development Research Foundation, the cabinet ministers, or parallel to cabinet ministers here. And again, they suffer from the same problem, which is basically fragmented notions. So here's an example of fragmented solutions. If you want to reduce crime, you have more police. If you want to promote skills, you build more schools. If you want to have greater health, you hire more doctors and more medical facilities. If you want teenage pregnancy to go down, you have pregnancy prevention programs. To reduce inequality, you give cash transfers and promote housing programs for the poor. Now, I'm not saying any of these things don't work, but what I am suggesting is there's a better way, which is actually a way that is a policy of prevention rather than remediation. And I want to try to sketch a unified approach to all of these problems, and that's the important thing. It's not just a program that essentially helps this group or that group. It's an approach that actually takes these problems, understands what their origins are, and builds on it. So what is the argument? The argument is actually very simple, and as I said at the beginning, it's commonsensical. First of all, skills matter. This is obvious, but it's more obvious than it ever has been in the past. There really has been a decline. 50 years ago, somebody could not graduate high school, get a good job at an auto factory, and that kind of opportunity is declining. There are still places where that's true, but it's not true much in the world. And it's even getting less true in a country like China, although it's more true there than it is here. Low levels of these skills, and this is the important thing, are major causes of social problems. So when we think about skill, it's not just who's at the factory showing up on time and with skills and productivity, but a lot of problems come from a common core of what I call capabilities or skills, namely things like dropping out of school, crime, teenage pregnancy, obesity, poor health, are all linked to this core set of skills. Now, what we have to decide, and I heard already in the discussion, I guess the November 2nd report will be out, which will more or less, as I gather, give you scores on a standardized achievement test for Kentucky. And this is true around the world, so it's not just Kentucky, and it's not just the United States. current policy discussions focus on these cognitive skills. They look at achievement tests. So No Child Left Behind scores are very important. In OECD Europe, PISA scores receive attention. In China, they're worried about the PISA scores for the children in Shanghai. Now, we know that these cognitive skills matter. They do. They are very important, and to say otherwise, it would just be denying the facts. But what we've come to understand, and I'll show you a little bit of evidence on that, is that other skills, and this, again, I think is obvious. It's obvious as the day is long. Personality skills, soft skills, physical and mental health, perseverance, attention, motivation, self-confidence are also important. Character. Character is a neglected word. It's an important concept, and it's very important. I don't know how many of you ever have watched recently or ever watched this movie called The Hustler. It's even got a scene in Louisville. I don't know if you remember the theme in The Hustler. The only reason why I mention it is if you recall, Paul Newman was a very skilled character player, pool player. But his handler, or a person who became his handler, George C. Scott, I don't remember the name in the movie, the actual character's name, basically told the guy, well, you know, you're really talented, but the reason why you're a loser, and he called him a loser, is because you lack character. And the character was to really stay with it, to really stay with it and to actually pace yourself. And so these traits, which, and you'll see this everywhere. Character, you can quote Confucius, and I did last week. So we're talking 2,500 years ago, Confucius, and it's true in virtually every religious and cultural text, major text. These personality skills are extremely important. Perseverance. Sometimes they're called non-cognitive skills. I like to call them character. They're really very important. And what we've come to understand is these things are important and equally important for many. Recently now, there's actually Nova is going to put out a series about how you create genius. And, you know, I don't know if anybody remembers the famous phrase of Thomas Edison that genius was 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Well, there are counterparts to that everywhere. And that's why I say this is all very obvious. Except public policy doesn't recognize it. We don't measure it, and we don't even try to cultivate. So that's important. That's kind of lesson one that I really want to put on the table. The second is that the gaps in all of these skills between the advantage and the disadvantage open up very early. They actually open up long before children enter school. And so what we need to understand is schools actually contribute very little to the widening and narrowing of the gaps. Even though we think we can do something with school, I'm not saying there aren't important areas to improve the public schools, but something that's been out on the table, that's found in study after study, is that schooling, although it has an effect, what's going on in the family has a much bigger effect than what children are doing in school. And actually, what children bring to school before they even enter it turns out to be far more important than what schools are doing. So it's not saying schools don't matter. It's simply saying what matters more, prioritization. Now, what we have to understand, and this is controversial, people don't like to discuss it, but it's part of the same story. And I realize that neither candidate, probably very few candidates for office anywhere, can really discuss what is a major issue. The major issue is, of course, the family. The family plays an important, essential role, major producers of all these traits. The family does much more than pass on its genes, although it does that for sure, and genes are important, there's no question. Cognitive and social skills, however, these personality and character traits, and as well as cognitive traits, are not fixed at birth. They are not solely genetically determined. And what we've come to understand in terms of a lot of recent research is how the family and the environments more generally affect even the way genes express themselves. It's called epigenetics. So what we've come to understand is the powerful role of the family. But if we look at American society, and this is the neglected story of American society, is that family environments around the world have deteriorated. It's not just in the U.S. It's true in the U.S., but it's also true in China. It's true in many other countries, to a different extent, to a different degree. I'll show you some statistics just briefly. So supplementing the family, and that's what these programs are about, supplementing the family and its resources, engaging it and enriching the early lives of children, is actually really an effective policy. So what we've learned is that society intervenes early enough in a consistent fashion over the life cycle of a child, it can promote both the cognitive and character skills as well as the health and well-being of children. So when we think about reducing health care costs, frequently people say, well, we got to get better incentives for physicians. They want to break the donut hole. There, all these things are true. But there's also another policy, which is prevention in the first place, which is having children not grow up obese, having children not grow up with the kind of inability to regulate and self-regulate, which we know is an important determinant of adult health. In fact, if you want to know what is a greater predictor of longevity, it's not IQ. It's actually conscientiousness, how well one handles oneself, character, some character trait. By the way, I would say that none of these are very good predictors, so for the very conscientious, don't get your hopes up, but nonetheless. But what we've understood, though, is these multiple channels, these percolate across the life cycle, and that's where the prioritization has to come in. Again, it's very intuitive. So these early interventions help by essentially building a base downstream. So they actually lead to greater workforce productivity. And so from a purely economic standpoint, if we start comparing, which wasn't done in the Stimulus Act a few years ago when various policies were put in place, very few estimates were available that said, what's the rate of return? What's the rate of return, just in a pure business sense, to this policy versus that policy? And what we've come to understand is that the early childhood interventions, which have been evaluated, I've participated in those evaluations, have rates of return that actually exceed the rate of return on the stock market between 1945 and before the meltdown, 2006, 2007. So you're getting a return that's somewhere between 7 to 10%. And I think that's understated because it doesn't include the healthcare benefits and the full social benefits. So early interventions that build a skill base have much higher return than later remediation. That's intuitively obvious. But the work in neuroscience, the work in genetics, a work in a lot of different knowledge bases come together to say, yes, much easier and much more solid policy to prevent than to try to remediate downstream. And the reason for this is something, again, that I think is obvious. But it's important, the dynamics of skill formation. Skill begets skill, motivation begets motivation. And we know that if a child's not motivated and stimulated to learn and engage early enough, the more and more likely it is the child will fail downstream. So the longer we wait to intervene, the more costly it is to remediate. And we know in some extreme cases it's even impossible with what we currently understand. So we need a skill policy that implements this. And we need to have a major refocus of policy, moving away from remediation, moving away from trying to say, let's build better jails, let's think about convict rehabilitation programs, let's even have better job training programs. That's something that both candidates have mentioned. And let's think about a policy downstream in 20 years from now where the U.S. society will be highly productive and will essentially then avoid a lot of the costs in health, in job training, remediation, prisons, and so forth. So what is the policy? Let me illustrate one, just try to document a few of these facts. Maybe they're all obvious, in which case I can sit down. They obvious? They are obvious. I completely agree. But I want to show you some facts, because I think facts are useful. I think as long as the facts are real. So I'll show you these facts. So the importance of cognitive and character skills. Let me try to understand, show you, and just give you a couple of graphs that show you what's going on. Recently, and I'd say in the last 15 or 20 years, there's a new book out by Paul Tough. I don't endorse it. I mentioned the book. A group of people I work with has mentioned. I think the book is something like How to Have Successful Children, How to Build Success and Successful Child, How to Make a Successful Child. It sounds like a Dr. Spock of the 21st century. It's not quite. But what it is, it's a book that talks about the importance of character skills. So what we know, cognitive skills are important, but things like motivation, sociability, self-regulation, self-esteem, these things, these so-called soft skills, actually there's a lot of evidence that they're very hard. Let me just give you a graph that shows how important these skills are. So let's look at a graph which is asked, what's the probability that a child who now measured at age 30, we have data following these children over their whole lifetime, but let's look at age 30. And we look at a measure of cognitive ability taken in the early teenage years. So it's a measure related somewhere between IQ and what an achievement test would be. And what this graph is showing, if you look at it, as you go from the left to the right on this graph, what you're going to see is at the bottom on the left, you're going to see kids who are at fairly low ability in terms of cognition. This is a well-established fact that smarter people are much less likely to be in jail Maybe they're better criminals, so they didn't get caught. But there are other things, too. They don't even get arrested. So there are other. So I realize each graph has its own interpretation. But nonetheless, there is But what if we measure, at the same age, measures of traits that have to do with character, motivation, conscientiousness? And what we also see is a huge decline. So early on, if we can actually change those traits or somehow affect those traits, and I'll try to convince you that we can, that we can see that there are dramatic differences. Those people who are highly motivated, those people who have high, I've boiled everything down to personality and cognition. There are many more traits than that, but this is a simple summary of those traits, that those traits are equally important in the sense when you move from the bottom of the distribution to the top, we find kids at the top are unlikely to be committing crime, unlikely to be arrested. And if we look at things like teenage pregnancy, so the same thing is true, a very strong relationship between how smart a child is in the teenage years and pregnancy. But if you look at the measures of non-cognitive skills, they're just as important in the same sense. They move down, almost overlap in this graph. If you ask another question that was raised, what's the probability of being a four-year college graduate by age 30? You can see that both cognitive factors and these personality factors, these character skills, are important in producing these skills. Now, somebody mentioned, Mr. Atkinson mentioned the GD program, so I will talk about that since I've talked about it. I hope you don't have too active a GD program. I've studied it. I have a book on it. But the GD program is an interesting case, and it shows why looking only at test scores can be very, very misleading. So the GD, you probably all know. It's something that high school dropouts take. It's a test. It's an achievement test. And it's taken by children, high school students, usually dropouts, and certifies that they are the equivalents of high school graduates. American society uses that. Currently, 12 to 13% of all high school credentials issued around the country, I don't know what it is in Kentucky, but 12 to 13% of all high school credentials are achieved by this degree. At one time, it was as high as 18% for the country as a whole. So one out of every five high school graduates, the so-called high school graduates. Now, we studied this program. I studied it. It fascinated me. I visited a job training program in Corpus Christi some 20 years ago, and I was fascinated when this job training program, which I evaluated, it was part of an evaluation that started under Reagan and was finished under Clinton, and I was shown a class of students, and these students were starting out with 6 years of school, and within 2 months, 3 months, they had a GED and were certified as high school graduates. Initially, I said, as an economist, I said, that's a wonderful deal. If in 3 months you could make up for 6 years of schooling, everybody should take the GED. We should shut down the high schools. But then I got interested in the GED. The GED turns out to be a very successful test, measured by the same measure of success that we're measuring our schools. So here's an example. Here's a test. Here's actually what happens. If you look at the cognitive ability, you get the same pattern for males and females. So I'll just show you the pattern for males. That what you find is that ordinary so this is a distribution. It's the bell-shaped curve of cognitive skills. So it's like a normal curve. It's not really normal, but it's close. And you get this curve with a mean and then a tail to the right and a tail to the left. And what you can see is the GEDs are almost as smart. Their distribution of test scores is pretty close to that of high school graduates. And the dropouts are much lower. So the test does its job. It separates the wheat from the chaff. These are people who are smart, and they're certified to be smart. Just like PISA, no child left behind, and I'll bet you your test results coming out on November 2nd will certify those kids are smart. But what happened to the GEDs? Well, it's interesting, because the GEDs are actually performing at the level of high school dropouts. So when you actually follow them over their lifetime, and we follow these kids into their 40s, the GEDs are actually failing in virtually everything. So it's not just they dropped out of school. They drop out of the military. They drop out of marriage. They drop out of just about everything they start, including college. So if you ask how many of the GEDs actually go on to finish college, you'll find very few do compared to those who graduate high school. And so what we did is we actually studied and took measures and followed these people now over a lifetime, or at least into their mid-40s. We looked at these people and said, what about their non-cognitive skills? Their non-cognitive skills, if you look at this distribution, you'll realize, if you remember, the GEDs were very close to the high school graduates in terms of their ability distribution. Now, in terms of this distribution of character, They're actually down on the lower tail. That's not to say the GED program doesn't have some value. In fact, it does. For teenage girls who drop out, there's a lot of evidence of success. But the fact of the matter is this shows the failure of most, certainly for the male GEDs, most of them to succeed. Some succeed. Bill Cosby's a GED. They're famous GEDs. So is Paris Hilton, by the way. So so it's not all a success story. But the point is that this, to me, is kind of a laboratory. But it's actually a laboratory that's highly relevant to what we're doing. And just to go one step further, counting GEDs as dropouts actually distorts the American statistics. It's one of the reasons why our high school dropout rate has actually increased as we've had this GED program. And if you count GEDs as dropouts, as I think all the evidence suggests you should, the improvement in the African-American high school graduation rate has vanished. It's the same as it was in 1960. No progress whatsoever. And in fact, it's even more pernicious. The apparent improvement is an illusion fostered by the use of the GED. A substantial portion of the growth, this is in the African-American male high school graduation rate, is due to the expansion of the GED in the prison system and the explosion of mass incarceration of black males. So we're hiding a problem with these things. So I don't want to go on about the GED, although I could, but I want to simply say that there is a lot of evidence that other traits matter, and we can measure those traits. It's not like this is soft, wishy-washy stuff. We have measures, and these measures are highly predictive. Let me go to a second issue, and this is the question that's received a lot of attention in this election: income inequality and intergenerational mobility. We've seen, I already mentioned the statistic about China, the U.S. versus Denmark. We've seen a lot of emphasis on income inequality as a major determinant of child disadvantage. And it's been suggested by some, and there are a lot of books out now, popular books, people, some of the candidates, not so much articulating this particular position I'm about to enunciate, but have argued that income distribution itself could be highly effective in producing greater opportunity for disadvantaged children. But I think we have to be very careful. I think we learned that lesson 50 years ago in the Great Society, that simple transfers of income are not really what's going to help the next generation get off of welfare. That was something that was arrived at through a bipartisan discussion. It came through data. And so it was President Clinton who actually put in office, put into operation a welfare reform that essentially suggested that income transfers didn't matter that much, didn't help. You can reduce poverty for sure in this generation, and it did. The war on poverty did reduce poverty. But did it help people in the next generation? No, it did not. And that was what was the critical motion in drought reforming welfare. So I would go back and say, what is the true measure of child poverty? It's not income, actually. Even though income is a correlate, I would say the true cause is parenting. We go back to the family. It's the parenting that matters. So let me then get to a second document, and this I think is extremely important. Skill gaps, not income gaps, explain the difference in enrollment between majorities and minorities. There's a lot of concern about the gap, say the high school completion gap between whites and blacks, whites and Latinos. And if you look at the first row on this graph, on the left side in blue, you'll see the black-white gap, the white-black gap, suggesting that whites are 6 points more likely to graduate high school, complete high school, than blacks. White-Latino gap, this is in a single data set in the later years, so it doesn't represent the 40 years that I was talking about. The white-Latino gap is even greater. That's also known. But one thing that's very interesting is once you adjust for ability, the ability that children have at the time they're deciding to drop out or not, the gap actually reverses. The blacks are more likely to graduate high school, and Latinos are more likely to graduate. And if we look at the college enrollment gap, we see a similar pattern. And this, I think, is partly a matter of effective affirmative action policies and the like. So what we've actually seen is that ability adjusted, there's a gap. Now, people don't like to talk about this. Sometimes people say it's blaming the victim, and I think we've moved beyond this. I think we really have to understand that abilities matter. They're highly predictive of success. And this is what's staggering and I think quite important, these ability gaps open up very early. So here's an example taken from a data set where we, again, track kids at least until the early 20s. These are kids where the only reliable measures of cognition really are age 3. Before age 3, it gets a little flaky. And what you can see, if the top figure, maybe I should do this sequentially. Oops, I'm switching it. So that's the test score for a child whose mother is a college graduate. If we look at some college graduate, you see a somewhat lower performance of the child. Again, lower yet, high school graduate mother, and then a mother who's a dropout. Now, you'll notice something. To me, the most striking fact is not the difference. We've known that for a long time. But the gap at 18 that helps explain differences of who goes to college, who doesn't, explains performance, who's successful, who's not, success in a lot of different dimensions. The gap that's there at 18 is there at 5 before when kids are entering school. In fact, it's also more or less there at age 3. And the other part is that these gaps aren't really being changed all that much by American schools, even though we know they're very unequal. This is a national sample of U.S. A lot of unequal schools here, a lot of advantage and disadvantage. So the James Coleman finding of some 50 years ago that family matters, that these other whatever is going on in the family matters a great deal, and these gaps are real. So there's a question. You look at this gap, and now this is the source of controversy. What causes this? This by itself doesn't prove anything. So suppose that I'm a hardcore geneticist, or a person who believes, not a geneticist, but a person who believes in genes or the power of genes. I could simply say, look, this is just an example. Smart kids have smart parents, and all you've done is have inherited. It's inheritance. So the question is, looking at this graph by itself tells you very little, actually. It tells you that something's going on important in the early years, but is it genes, is it family environments, and so forth? And what I want to suggest is there's a lot of evidence, and I'll just show you a little bit of it. I don't want to bombard you. I already have bombarded you, but I'll show you a little bit of this evidence that, in fact, family life matters. But before I do, let me just remind you of something which is unpleasant. I haven't seen this put up by any candidate for office at any level. But I think it's an important graph for understanding what's going on in America today. So, for example, if you look at the percentage of children under 18 living in single-parent families, you can see now, as of the year 2010 anyway, that there's a big chunk, close to 30%. This is across all race groups, all ethnic groups, where you essentially have a single-parent family. And the big source of growth has been in families where the mother was never married. It's never married environments. And we know that those are the ones that are most compromised. And a figure that has received more attention, at least got some attention in the national press a year ago, is the percentage of births to unmarried women in the United States, and it's now reached over 40%. So when we study these homes, we know they're relatively disadvantaged, not only in terms of income, in terms of the resources available to children. This is a phenomena that's driving a lot of our skills problem. And by the way, this graph is not atypical for a lot of other countries around the world. You can go to Chile, 50% of the kids are born out of wedlock. In Mexico, it's even higher. And you can go to many other countries, advanced and not advanced. And this isn't the question of highly educated women choosing not. Some are in here in this graph. Mostly, it's women who are less educated, less advantaged, and the children grow up in environments that are severely compromised. Now, what do we know about those environments? We know a lot. A lot has gone on. So, for example, if we just look at a difference of how much the child's vocabulary at age 2 is, 26 months, what you see is when the mother has a high level of speech, the child, of course, is going to get a high level of speech because it's that interaction between the mother and the child, the environment and the child, that actually builds the vocabulary and the cognition and the character of the child. So you can see there are substantial gaps that are emerging long before school begins. And another famous study, Hart and Risley, showed, for example, children from different environments, you know, roughly less educated, more educated, welfare, working class, and professional, the number of words those children actually hear in a typical hour is enormous in terms of the range of variation. It's more than 3 to 1 difference in the number of words. And also the quality of the parenting environment, the number of affirmatives versus prohibitions. There are really fundamentally different parenting styles out there, and parenting is a scarce resource in this whole business. And this aggregates. If you accumulate cumulative experiences, you can see that, you know, this is just a little multiplication here. The words heard in 4 years, a professional family will give the child like 45 million words, welfare family, less than a third of that. And so you get an effect even before, at the beginning of my previous graph, where I was showing results at age 3, these things really are huge in the sense of the richness of the environment. So again, the question is, maybe this is just genetics. What is it that really matters? It's amazing how little we understand the family. An intuitive level, we all know the family is very important. But what is it about the family that matters? And what can we do as a society when families, at least the traditional families, are under challenge? That's the issue. That really is the issue, and that's what these policies are all about. These policies are family supplementation policies. So what can we say? What do we know? Well, I will show you, there's a lot of work on this, and we can talk about it, but let me talk about the Perry Preschool Program, which is one of many programs which I could talk about. The advantage of the Perry Program is twofold. One, it's longstanding. The children are now 50 years of age. We followed them in a systematic way to age 40. We recently received funding to follow them to age 50. And we can actually see what these children do. Well, what was the program? I think you probably all have heard of the program. Disadvantaged African-American children in a suburb of Detroit, Ypsilanti, Michigan. I don't know if anybody knows Ypsilanti. That's where Rosie the Riveter was. Because the factory she worked in is closed. It's a kind of a testing ground, but it's a testing ground for child development. Kids were randomly assigned to a curriculum, and only for 2 years. They were three and four when they were assigned. And what was the curriculum? It wasn't Baby Einstein. It wasn't sort of saying, here, kid. There was vocabulary. It wasn't like they were trying to make these kids into geniuses. Kids were brought in every day, and they were told, okay, plan a task, do a task, and then review the task collectively. A strong emphasis on social and emotional skills, staying on course, self-control. Nowadays, there's a version of this, Tools of the Mind has actually tried to implement versions of this. So what do we know about this program? First of all, if you measured it by what was the measure of the day, this was now in the 1960s when it started to evaluate it, in early 70s, what you saw was an interesting pattern, which has been found in many of these studies, that the Perry program showed kids at entry, they were randomized to be low IQ. That was the requirement. So this is a below average population in terms of IQ, but that's how the program got funded. Within their first year of the program, their IQ shot up 15 points. Everybody said, a miracle has occurred in Ypsilanti. And then what happened was the population, the IQ scores vanished. That's for the treatment group. What happened to the control group? By age 10, they were more or less the same in terms of IQ. At that point, everybody said, this program is a failure. We didn't boost IQ. That was the premise of a lot of the War on Poverty programs, was really boosting low IQ, boosting cognition, because the measure of success was cognition. So we followed these children. And we follow them to age 40. Now, I mentioned earlier that some of these programs have 7 to 10% rate of return. This program does. We follow them to age 40. We find reduced crime, substantially reduced crime. We find increased education for the women. We find increased earnings for both men and women. We have substantial improvements. And the main mechanism was through personality and these character skills. That was the mechanism. So IQ was no higher, but the children were actually performing at a very successful way. And there are other proven interventions. If you start even earlier, it turns out you can't even boost IQ. So there really are some interventions that can do that. So what do we know about this? I think we need to really step back from this and say, what is going on here? Well, certainly true, as I've tried to illustrate with two examples, that it's not just cognition, that these other traits matter. They're extremely important. And as this program and many other programs like it show, we can boost it. But how do these programs work effectively? They're supplementing the family. The most effective ones are working with the family. And they're actually providing substitute and enriched parenting that maybe the children don't have. It's the parenting that I argue is what's really the true measure of child poverty. And so we have a modern understanding of life cycle dynamics of skill formation. We understand that it's dynamic in nature, that skill begets skill. These skills cross-fertilize each other. So this, again, is common sense. But a highly motivated child will learn more. They'll engage more in school. A healthier child will learn more because doesn't have asthma, won't have missed school days. a child who actually is more engaged, like, for example, personality and social skills. The child will sit still, pay attention, engage in learning, and so forth. Health, frequently neglected, is an important dimension. I didn't show all the benefits of health from these cognitive and non-cognitive skills, but the channels through which these programs operate is through boosting this set of capabilities. And there's a dynamic synergism where a kid who falls behind and gets increasingly far behind just gets lost from the system. And the remedial efforts that we have done so far have not been all that successful. So I think we really have to understand what economists would call dynamic complementarities, or Buckminster Fuller would have called synergism. Just the fact is these skills cross-fertilize each other. And they produce not just better schools, not just better children in terms of achievement test scores, but also better, healthier children, more motivated children, children who do less crime or more suited to the service in the military, less obese, and on and on and on. So this dynamic synergism has to be exploited. Now, we come to the debate. We come to a lot of the discussions about job training programs today. What do we know about later remediation? This is the part of economics that people don't like. That's why it's sometimes called a dismal science. It's not because the science is bad. It's the message is bad sometimes. It's very dismal. What we've come to understand, and I did this, how I got into this whole business because I was evaluating job training programs, things like JTPA, if anybody remembers what that was. It's now been replaced by the Workforce Investment Act, and before it were various versions. Job Corps. Does anybody know what the rate of return is to Job Corps? It's been experienced. Zero. Zero rate of return. I found, for example, in the JTPA, so that's an experimental study that was done by the Department of Labor with results published a few years ago. All of the job training, so we know that it's politically possible. I remember years ago I talked to an economist who was advising a candidate back in the 60s, and even then it was known that job training was not all that effective, but the candidate said, I have to do it because everybody believes it's effective. But here's a case where politicians, informed citizens, really should educate. As currently implemented, most of these adolescent remediation programs have nowhere near these returns. And some of them are actually structured incorrectly. So public job training programs generally have a very, very poor record. Adult literacy programs, unfortunately, do. I don't say this with pleasure. Tuition reduction programs, by the way, when I showed it the gap, the minority gap, many people point to income as a big issue. It's partly a matter, but it's not just income. It has to do much more with ability and abilities formed early in life. So what we found is something that is actually very disequalizing. Namely, if you want to ask where do you best spend your money for people who go to college, it's probably for those who are the brightest and the most motivated. You get rates of return that are 22% per annum. That's a very high rate of return. And you say it's, and for kids who are not very able, not very motivated, the college investment decision is not that profitable. People don't want to hear that, but it's true. But the good news in all this is you can build the skill base so that this kind of disequalization that's true at 18 doesn't have to arise in the first place. But that's why we have to understand the base, the dynamics of this. Like, it's common sense. It's like growing a tree or growing a plant. You've got to get the base right. Once you get the base right, you get these very high returns, and those can be shared across the country. So the general pattern is strong returns on later life for the more able, lower returns for the less able. But now there's a social question. And so I don't want to just stop with early childhood. What should we do for adolescents who do not receive the skill-enhancing programs that many of you support? I would argue that you should recognize a few facts, some of which I've tried to give today. Recognize the skill base has been compromised. Recognize that social and personality skills are actually more malleable until the later ages than cognitive skills. We understand that. In fact, it's the basis of Supreme Court cases, where we actually see that the so-called slowly development prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that's governing judgment. We know that teenagers, especially some of the teenagers involved in really bad crimes and so forth, maybe really haven't fully developed. I don't want to make excuses for them, but we know that there's more malleability in these so-called character and non-cognitive skills. And so what has been promising for kids who've dropped out is workplace-based education that emphasizes discipline, self-control, and engagement. You know, the American high school, as we know it, is a fairly recent development. Somebody was mentioning in this package here, Abraham Lincoln, Kentuckian. Okay, Abraham Lincoln really didn't do too many years of high school. What he did do was apprentice. And at the apprentice, he was basically, that's how he learned to be a lawyer, right? He was reading books at night, but he also apprenticed. The apprenticeship, some version of workplace-based education that emphasizes discipline and self-control, these show promise. I'm not saying they have the same rate of return as early childhood programs, but if we have to remediate, we should think differently than about boosting IQ or raising the score on some achievement test. What about promoting education? And this will be my last slide, and I'll sit down and we can take some questions. What about promoting education? Everybody likes education, and I like education too. Remember at the last debate, I think it was Governor Romney who said, I like teachers, and I think Bob Schieffer said, Governor Romney, we all love teachers, and I think that's true. And teachers are very important. I'm not going to minimize that. But teachers are made effective by having children who are ready to learn from those, and they engage them. So this is a favorite goal. The Gates Foundation, many foundations are trying to help schools and focusing at the high school. Not going back to realizing the reason why a lot of high schools are failing is that by the time kids are entering high school, they lack the social, emotional, and cognitive skills that let them prosper in high school. What we've come to understand is that boosting the capabilities of children entering school actually is a major benefit of education. Let me just show you a graph. This is taken from British data. And so let me put this graph together. The height of each of these bars is what is the effect of going beyond minimum school leaving education. So if you go beyond the minimum school leaving years, you can see substantial returns for both males and females, M and F. You can see that the total height of the bar is what the return is. Substantial returns in wages, employment, exercise, healthy behavior, reductions in obesity, improvements in health, reductions in depression, and reduction in smoking. But if you break down, this is the kind of measured return to education. This is what you'll get from the census. This is what you'll see debated on the floor of Congress, and you'll see debated in many public policy forums, the total height of the bar. How much of that is actually due to the causal effect of education, actually receiving the education, and how much of that education is a consequence of early life factors that led to the education? And the main message here is that a substantial portion, for most, but not all of these outcomes, is caused by this early life factor. And so it's something to take in mind that even when you look at schooling, and we see, yes, there are substantial returns to schooling, what constitutes that is actually these early life factors. So what have we learned? I think what I really would try to emphasize is prevention should be the strategy. Early investment produces returns over the whole life cycle, and we need to prioritize. And so here's a graph that I've shown to many people, and I will show here, and this will be really my final graph. Literally, if we ask, do a hypothetical thought experiment. I'm an economist. We think about models. We ask, suppose we're at the beginning of a life of a child, the beginning of a life, not at age 18, not at age 10, but at the beginning of the life. And we ask ourselves, this is an investment project called a child. And what I want to do is, where should I spend the majority? Where do the highest returns occur in terms of, saying, producing a child just purely as an economic investment? And what I find, and what is found in a large body of literature, and this takes literature from across the life cycle, programs targeted towards the earliest years have very high returns, the highest. Why? Because they build the base downstream for the return. So at age 18, there can be very high returns for people who got the base. But what's the counterpart in terms of quantity? This is a rate of return, the dollar, like passbook savings account, how much you get per year on a dollar invested in the child. And in equilibrium, if we actually invested wisely, we would invest a lot in the early years and relatively less in the later years. Not zero, but relatively less. But what do we know about disadvantaged kids? We know that it's actually just the opposite. We spend a lot more on remediation, on prisons, on some kind of remediation effort, and much less on investment in the early years. So that's what the message of this graph is, and I think we don't prioritize sufficiently. And I think the logic is obvious. So let me just summarize my talk today. I've tried to address the problem of rising inequality and lack of social mobility in American society. Skills are very important, but you have to think about the skills problem in a different and, I think, more inclusive way. You have to understand that there's more than IQ, there's more than achievement. You have to understand that social and emotional skills are quite important. You also understand something that's an obsolete notion, that IQ, that these traits are given at birth, that we somehow were set in stone, we're born. These things are genetically determined. They're not. They can be fostered. There's a substantial component. We have to understand that the process of building skills is a dynamic, synergistic process. Skills begets skills, motivation begets motivation, and this notion of synergism, complementarity, plays a very huge role. So that's why it's so productive to invest in, especially, public investments or public-private investments, the mechanism of investment. I strongly encourage public-private investments for many reasons. Bringing in the private sector not only brings resources, it also brings in subtlety. It recognizes cultural differences. It recognizes religious and value differences. But these things, that's an important aspect. But nonetheless, the investments need to be made. These early investments create a base for enhancing the productivity of later investments. And typically, as this graph and the logic is showing, that we really are finding substantial gaps between the haves and the have-nots. The true measure of disadvantage, at least for children and for childhood, is the quality of parenting, the environment that children get at their home. It's not a question of money. Parental stimulation, engagement, and attachment are crucial. These parental resources promote resilience to adversity and promote investment. So in Chicago, we have many examples of very successful families. Years ago, now it's torn down, but we had a project called the Robert Taylor Homes. Very bad in the sense of having high crime rate. Many people say these are, you know, people living in these projects were extremely poor. And there were gangs, there was a lot of crime. It wasn't a very good environment for raising a child. So many people say children raised in that environment all grew up to be criminals. They didn't. The vast majority grew up to be middle class. And you ask, what was it about those kids who grew up to be middle class? How did they engage in the larger society? You look at the family, and you look in the mother in particular in those families, where she creates an environment which essentially is giving the child high-quality protection, engaging the child. And it wasn't a question just of money. It was really a question much more of a conscientious mother taking care of the child. So these matter. Now, we should also understand that the family is under challenge. And I think that's the issue that really has to be understood, that we are really talking about a family policy. And I realize that's maybe impolitic, but I'm not a politician, so I can be I can afford to make bold statements. And I think it's important. I think it's really important in the sense of the black-white gap, a gap between the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-nots. This is an important ingredient. So we want to move beyond family income. We want to move beyond some of the previous policies. And I would just conclude with a note that when we think about solving the problems of inequality, most people think about alms, redistribution. I would argue you don't want redistribution. You want pre-distribution. What you want to do is you essentially want to create the base so that early on people will have agency, they can flourish on their own. These people will be able to walk on their own 2 feet. It's the investment, not redistribution. It's not just giving alms. It's not just transferring. There may be some scope for that. I'm not arguing against that. But I'm saying something that has a very unusual quality in public policy. It has a very high economic rate of return, and it's also socially fair. That's why. So there's no trade-off between we see today in the taxation, you know, should we reduce capital gains taxes or something? People say, well, it helps the rich. We always hear the trade-off, the efficiency equity trade-off. Here there really is no trade-off. There really is no trade-off because you are promoting economic efficiency. You're making a more skilled workforce. You're bringing people out. At the same time, you actually are redistributing. You're attacking the problem of poverty at its source, and you're attacking the problem of intergenerational poverty at its source. So in that regard, we know that if society helps early enough in the lives of children in a sustained way, supplements the family, works in a cooperative way, not replacing the family, it can actually promote the health of children, promote cognitive and character skills, and promote the life of the larger society. So thank you very much for your attention. Okay, I'll stand. Oops.
Professor Heckman has agreed to take a few questions if you are able to stay with us. I know we've run a little bit long today. And two of our early childhood staff have mics around the room. So if you would just stand up if you've got a question for Dr. Heckman, and Albert or Joe will come and bring you the microphone.
Dr. Heckman, thank you for your speech. Those of us who advocate on behalf of programs for young children are frequently posed the question, do we provide more access for more children, or do we increase the quality of the programs we have? Do you have research or data that should inform us?
Yes, and I think I hear this question a lot. I mean, again, when my trip to China, China, by the way, is investing now, are starting to invest heavily. I know everybody invokes the China threat. I'll say now China is actually going to be doing early childhood as a result of this conference last week, and big scale. There is a question, though, that low-quality early childhood education can actually lead to harm. See, that's the important thing. What happens, this happened in my own state. Many of you probably heard of Rod Blagojevich. I don't know if any of you... Okay, well, I actually had a meeting with Rod, not recently, but I had a meeting with him about 6 years ago at the University of Chicago. He was a very engaging person, by the way, a very lively man, not just talkative. But we had this discussion, and I talked to him about the benefits of early childhood. Diana Rauner and several others were attending that meeting. And what came out of it was an initiative in Illinois for expanding early childhood. But it was a very diluted kind of program, typical, I guess, of Blagojevich. So it's something that I think is politically very, very salient. I'm doing something. It's good. We know generally it's good. And you expand the program. The trouble is that these low-quality child care programs can either be ineffective or harmful. Why do I say harmful? We know that there is some evidence that in some kids, at least those who have the right wrong, or at least a certain temperament, really need special attention in these centers. And they're sent to warehousing-type centers without very high quality. Their social and emotional problems can sometimes get substantially enhanced. And so I think it's not just a question of access. I really think it's a question of priority and providing quality for those who get the program. And I think, I don't know, I can't tell you, I don't believe the science or the empirical evidence is strong enough to argue. Some of these programs are extremely expensive. Probably much more expensive than anybody. Like EduCare right now is being put forth. George Kaiser in Oklahoma has supported this program. Per child, it's the average cost is about $25,000 per child. Very, very expensive per year. And that's a very expensive program. But it's a high-quality program. I don't think you need to go to that level. But I think what we do want to avoid is just kind of token programs that say, let's have more of this. Let's let everybody in, with the notion that something is better than nothing. It's not always true. I think you really want to have minimum standards and you want to have relatively high quality. Because especially at the early years, I mean, you're talking about a person, a caregiver, a teacher, really, a surrogate parent, really, or a supplementary parent who's actually working with the child and who's actually, in groups of three, four, or five, interacting with the child, scaffolding the child, taking the child along. And if that person is brutal, not sensitive, and so forth, the benefits of all this are going to go away or will not even be realized. And it could be even harmful if they kind of end up with taking the mother away or somehow the mother's not there. So it's a very delicate issue. That's why I think we really need programs that actually have moderately high quality and also work with the parents to try to also teach parenting, because the parents will be with the child a lot more than any of these daycare centers. And as Jeffrey Canada and many of the others have been working this program have suggested, something like baby college or something like training. I have a former student now at the University of Pennsylvania who's taken surveys, done some work on just the level of knowledge among certain disadvantaged populations about parenting. It's quite low. It's staggering. And that's why we really have to understand the problem is not just the child. It's the child, what's the child's getting from the parents, and enriching the parents, but doing it in a voluntary way, not telling anybody you're a bad parent or anything of the sort, but just providing the information. And so far, what I've seen is that most parents are very willing and receptive to the idea of getting this information and using it in that way. So I think you want a minimum quality, but you want to think more than just a center. You want to think about the child with the parent and the larger community, and trying to build an atmosphere that maybe is a little more encouraging, a little less discouraging, that might recognize the importance of the parent staying with the child and encouraging the child all the way through life.
Thank you. Albert, I think there's somebody in the back.
Hi, Dr. Heckman. I'm glad you brought up the PERI program and the strategy of prevention. I've been working with some high school students here in Jefferson County, and we're actually doing a project here next Friday at the Center for the Arts. It's if you Google Student Forum JCPS Board, you'll read you'll see more about it. Interesting, we had actually had a conversation with these kids, these high school kids, about Oklahoma. And Ron Peters over there, who put a universal pre-K, every fourth grader is in public pre-kindergarten or preschool. Met Angela Brandt over here in the back, and she said, we have a program here in Kentucky, but we approach students, four-year-olds, who meet the 150% of poverty rate, and that's our group that we focus on. Would you say the numbers support universal fourth grade, or four-year-olds in public schools for Kentucky, or do we just need to focus on our kind of small percentage?
Well, I'm an economist, and I think we're all in a world where, like it or not, we have to ration resources and use them wisely. And so I would argue that we would probably want to target first the children who are most disadvantaged. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have universal pre-K, but what it means then is you might want to start charging people who have higher levels of income and so forth and so on for the same services you provide. I think if you have limited public dollars and you need to target, I think you have to prioritize those where the returns are highest will be those in the early years who are the most disadvantaged. I think that's fair. But by the way, I wouldn't use 150% of the poverty line. I would use a more inclusive measure if you can get it, which is a measure of parenting. See, I was referring to Paris Hilton earlier. My guess is that probably the parenting, I don't want to blame her parents, I know very little about it, but my guess is that something went wrong there. And so it's not just a question of money. No, and actually, though, in British Columbia, there's actually a very serious discussion about even among the middle class children. There are some cases where the parenting practices are such that when the children are screened to be ready for school, they aren't really that ready. So even those who are moderately... So I would say, yes, you want a screen, but be sure you use the right screen. You want something that's a little more inclusive. I realize it's a lot harder. Income measures we have, parenting measures less so. But I think in the end, maybe 20 years from now, when we're actually tackling this problem very wisely, we'll have good measures of parenting and better ways to actually try to engage the parent and understand that that's what these programs are really doing.